The Whopping Project is a vision which encapsulates new work, the commissioning of writers, poets, choreographers, composers, filmmakers, video makers and photographers.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Pass Forward, the Whopping Project at 20, with your host, myself, Gareth Evans, and I'm delighted for this particular episode to be in conversation with two wonderful artists, Marissa von Stockert and Karen Stuka. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you.
Great to have you with us at this particular time when we're thinking back to incredible projects under the auspices of the Whopping Project when it was in the building, of course, the building being the hydraulic power station in Whopping. And looking forward to the Whopping Project's wider rippling iteration across the world under the new directorship of Thomas and Marta, as regular listeners to this podcast series will know. Now, Marissa and Karen, you have very distinctive projects in different media that saw the light of day in the Whopping Project, and you both met the late great Jules Wright at different times. Now, Marissa, perhaps we could start with you, as you met Jules earlier, and your first encounter, I think, creatively with the Whopping Project was as part of a collective piece in which a number of artists contributed. But before we get on to that, can you remember your first meeting with Jules and how the invitation to work with her came about?
Yes, I first met Jules in 2002, it was, I think, when she invited me to create a 5-minute piece in the restaurant at the Whopping Project. The piece was commissioned by Jules and the Gerwood Foundation, who I think initiated the introduction. I had just started working as a choreographer in London, I think about 2 years earlier, and this was going to be my first site-specific piece ever. And I remember Jules gave me only one brief. The piece had to contain two white restaurant chairs and it had to be performed in the restaurant near the diners. And so, inspired by the location, I created a rather unorthodox eating ritual that played tongue-in-cheek with the fine dining context we were surrounded by. It was a duet for two female dancers, and I remember Jules was interested in what we were doing and sometimes watched rehearsals from afar, but she never interfered. She only insisted on one thing: we had to rehearse in the restaurant space itself, because she wanted people to observe the creative process, not just the performances. And I found this quite remarkable, as it was quite an innovative concept at the time. And so the dancers and I ended up spending about 2 weeks working daily at the Whopping Project. And the more time I spent there, the more I realized that this place was, it was run very differently from other art spaces I was used to. For one, Jules very cleverly combined the art of food with the art of creative experimentation. She also had been a very successful theatre director herself, and she, I think, understood artists in a particular way. Maybe also because she had studied psychology and could read people. She was aware of where one was at and what an artist needed at a specific time in their artistic development. I found that quite striking. And even after the performances had finished, I was drawn back to the space many times. And sometimes I would just go there to sit in a quiet corner, sort of at the edge of one of those large pieces of old machinery, just to get inspired and scribble ideas into a notebook. And then once in a while, Jules would come over and start a conversation and ask me what I was doing, how things were going. And she was very charismatic, but also generous and a great listener. She was always very entertaining and open, talking about her own stage production of the past. And there were always some crazy twists and turns and near disasters in the creative processes she described. And usually at the end, it all worked out fine. She could be very funny and at the same time offer interesting insights into how she used to work herself.
That's really, a tremendous kind of overview, a summary of Jules' own remarkable achievement, but also incredibly vivid introduction to your own encounter with both her and with the Bopping Project. Many thanks, Marissa. Just in terms of this project, of course, this was one of the Six White Chairs pieces. I'm very struck by how you rehearsed, and I didn't know about that aspect of the project before, but of course, as you say, you know, it absolutely indicates the kind of openness and the innovation of Jules's own response and her commissioning process as well. Now, Karen, perhaps we could establish your first meeting with Jules. I think it was almost exactly 10 years later in 2012. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah. I've been in London at that time for a couple of months, because I've always wanted to be in London, to be honest. And I try to get around and find people who might be interested in my work or so. And a friend of mine said, why don't you contact Jules Wright? Because she has a theatre background, like you have a theatre background, and she might like your work. I did send her an email with all my, not all my work, but with some of my series. So I'm working with Pinel Photography, and used to work very conceptual, like the exposure times were very conceptual. The exposure time is as long as an opera, for example. So I wrote Jules, and she wrote me immediately back, like, I want to see your portfolio. And so we met at Wapping, and I showed her another series called Sleeping Sister, where it's about sleep and the relation to unconsciousness and death and so on, and some other works. And then she started telling me about Austerlitz, the book by Sebald. And she said, do you know this book? I was like, no. And she told me about it, like, it's about this man and about like blurred memory and so on. And she said, you read the book, we might have a project. So that made me just really, really curious about her and the place, of course, and the book. So that was my first meeting with Jules.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, as Marissa said, in a way, you know, she was obviously very excited by your work and responded, you know, rapidly to your you know, unsolicited approach, but then found something, of course, you know, in what you were saying, that matched, you know, the Austerlitz project and kind of sowed this seed in you. Were you aware at that time of that kind of process being underway as such? I mean, it's again echoes what Marissa said really about the idea of kind of seeing what is in people, where they're up to, where what might be coming, and finding a way to activate that. Would that sound like, you know, what was going on for you at the time?
In a way, yes, because she obviously saw something in my pictures which would work with this book, which I obviously didn't know. So it was her giving it the first step. And so also what she said is like, you just start. And I felt very trusted, so I could do what I want, you know. So she let me go and do my own way, and she didn't interfere. So she was kind of curious, I think, as well, very much, but open to it and see what's happening and what kind of images I'll bring.
Now, this obviously led to a significant journey on your part, you know, both creatively and actually. And so give us a sense, if you could, of how the project then developed, you know, into its realization.
I just started to read the book while I was in London, which was actually good, because I found the book, the beginning, very difficult. So at some point I decided, hey, I'm in London, so I just go to the places which are described in the book. And this is why I found out that Sebald misnamed a street name which he describes, Alderney Street and Alderney Road. And just because I found out on the map, I realized that. And that's why I myself found out Sebald's writing like this fiction and fact, which I didn't know before, because I never read Sebald before. So now, thinking about it, I'm really glad that I found out myself, because that made me curious and that made me go. And for, you know, when I was back in Berlin, I still read the book, and then I was wondering about all the different topics which are in the book, also the kinder transport, and also some things which are just mentioned with one name, with one word, like for example, when he describes the kinder transport, he just mentions the winter trains, and so I researched the Winton trains and found out all this story about Nicholas Winton and the kinder transport from Park to London. And this was with this book in so and so many cases and very hidden between the lines. And so I did a lot of research, which ever since I do with my new works actually as well.
Very, very interesting. Let's hold now, hold at that point, at that station, perhaps we could say, and we'll come on to the actual installation of the work in a little while. But Marissa, back to you if we could, because this idea of site-specific engagement, of course, was crucial to your first encounter with Jules. And as you said, it was the first time you'd worked site-specifically, and a very distinctive first location it was in the restaurant. But of course, then, just a year or so later, you moved into the boiler house, of course, of the hydraulic power station, an extremely distinct and absolutely definitively site-specific location with all sorts of challenges and possibilities, of course. Now, I wonder if you could give us a flavour of how that larger commission came into being, and also what the initial challenges for your own creative process were by moving across the building like that.
One of the days when I was sitting in the restaurant, Jules approached me and said that she was thinking of commissioning an evening-long site-specific performance for the Boiler House, the main gallery space. And she wanted this new work to run for a whole month, every evening. And then to my great surprise, she asked me what I would do if I was to create such a piece. And I was a young choreographer with not much experience at all, and I had never created an evening-long work before. I'd only created sort of small-scale stage pieces of about 20 minutes length, and my only site-specific experience had been this five-minute piece for the restaurant. So I was completely surprised when she asked me this question. And of course, I didn't have an immediate answer to that question in terms of what I would create in that space. And as we continued this conversation another day, we somehow ended up chatting about childhood memories. And I told Jules that as a child, I used to sit for many hours in my room and listen to recordings of fairy tales on an old record player. And I vividly remembered the low voice of the narrator and the fear mixed with the excitement that some of these stories stirred up in me. To allow him to sit at a table, to eat from the plate, drink out of her cup, and to sleep in her bed. And that was it. Suddenly the idea was born to create a piece about fairy tales. Fairy tales and their underbelly of fears and desires. And then there was no further brief or creative directive. Jules gave me no artistic constraints. Again, she wouldn't interfere in any way, but trust me completely, which I thought was great. And really, I mean, unusual to give a young choreographer just full rein to do what she thought to do. And of course, practical planning went ahead and there were budget constraints, but Jules basically entrusted me to get on with it, choose the collaborators and start thinking about what I wanted to do. And this trust gave me confidence. And I decided to use five fairy tales as inspirational starting point. Four tales from the Brothers Grimm, the Frog King, Rapunzel, Snow White, and Cinderella. And Bluebeard by Charles Perrault. And of course, they were folk tales that had been orally transmitted over centuries and across countries before they were written down. And I was keen to subvert some of the obvious role plays, such as female characters that were portrayed as evil or helpless, their greatest achievement being to get married or a moral lesson, whilst men were often depicted as the rescuers. For example, I was interested in exploring Snow White in a more multifaceted way and to play with some of the psychoanalytical interpretations that I'd that I had read. So at the end of the Snow White section, I hinted at the possibility that the evil stepmother could have just been part of Snow White's psyche, or the incorporation of Snow White's own desires and her envy for her mother's relationship with her father. So this was echoed visually at the end of the scene, and both stepmother and Snow White, who had so far just been seen separately but never together, were now dancing exactly the same distorted movement sequence in unison but against separate walls that met in a corner. So you could see the sequence from two perspectives, one dancer front on and the other in profile. And sorry, I haven't really answered your question, actually, thinking about it.
No, I think, I mean, it's an incredibly evocative answer again. Many thanks indeed. I mean, people can find obviously much more information about the project on your website, obviously on the show's page there. But I'm very struck by the fact that, of course, as you were at the time when you were invited by Jules to undertake this commission, that this was running, you know, every evening for a month. Of course, this was a hugely ambitious step up for you in scale and durational terms. But of course, it was a complete sellout success. For many critics, it was the show of the year. It had a huge response, and presumably was a very significant part of your ongoing process, which we'll come to again in a little while. But many thanks, Marissa, for that. Now, those experiences, Karen, that Marissa had in this space, of course, an ambitious space which requires a distinct and ambitious response, were absolutely echoed, of course, in your own project, realization of the Austerlitz undertaking. Now, you had spoken earlier about, you know, this research, this coming to Seebald for the first time after Jules's introduction. Now, you'd done significant research creatively and geographically, historically, and locationally. Now, when you wanted to bring this, you know, to a kind of, you know, to a realization, to an installational realization in the Boiler House, what was the kind of creative trigger to how that would be manifested?
I mean, first of all, I've been overwhelmed by the power station, so. In the beginning, I had no idea about thinking about installation and so on, because I was so much into the book and overwhelmed by what happens so quickly, so that I was more in the book than thinking about installation. And that was a nice cooperation with Jules at the end, because she obviously knew the space, she was working with installations all the time, and I... before were more exhibiting in White Cube. And I still wanted to say that it's a big influence, this work, or Jules, to my work, because it was the first ever commissioned work in such a state. Before that, I had little jobs and so on, or I did my free works or in series, but a commissioned work in that state I never had before. So I became really insecure in what does Jules expect from me? Like, what does she want to see? And that's what I found out very quickly, that she just let me go. And that's what I said earlier, that she obviously trusts. And so that I could go and could find my own way and my own visual way. I had really no clue in the beginning. So I thought I'd just start somehow. And I start with the real historical sites, really existing still, which was in my case, the Liverpool Street Station. So I went there and started taking photos with my cardboard paper box, and actually didn't like the first outcomes. I found them quite boring and not telling me very much. So still reading the book, I came to the part where Austerlitz, the protagonist, has to stay at the psychological clinic, couldn't sleep at night, and so he did his London walks, and he was walking all the time. And that's what I thought, that's what I'm doing with my photography. So I took my pinhole camera and started walking while exposing. Thank you.
very interesting. Thank you very much indeed. Now, if we look at the again the relevant page on your website, you know, we'll see several iterations of this work. But I think one of the most striking, and of course for our purposes the most useful, is to look at the installation views, you know, from within the boiler house. Now, there was obviously a railway track laid in there, taking us on this this creative, historical, and imaginative journey. There were numerous screens, obviously showing your long exposure work, and there was a real sense of a kind of complete surround to the viewer's encounter with the work in the space. Now, I'm very struck by obviously what you've already spoken about regarding the long exposures, because of course for Sebaldian purposes that's perfect. The idea that you know the time stretches back, that history is never finished, if you like, that the view of a certain moment, a certain character, extends both forward and backward in all sorts of interesting ways. Now, when you saw this work installed, you know, you must have been kind of, I mean, just as I was when I saw it, you know, kind of overwhelmed by the transfer of an idea, you know, that started in a, you know, in a kind of casual approach, you know, to a curator into this scale realization. I guess it must have been a very significant moment for you.
It was indeed. And I remember when I came to London some days before the opening, because I'm used to help and before openings. And I think Jules was a bit surprised, like, why are you here that early? And then she watched me looking at the big images and the, you know, the rail tracks. And I didn't say nothing because I was indeed speechless. And so she looked at me and like, I thought afterwards, like, maybe she was even insecure if I liked it or not. So at some point she was like, do you like it? And I'm like, yes. So I what you said, I've been really overwhelmed myself. Plus the introduction of Billy Cowie's sound.
Yes.
I found it perfect. And Jules sent Billy my images and the topic, obviously, and he created the sound. And it was the first time I heard it, and I thought it's just a brilliant cooperation of all of us.
I mean, it's really, you know, striking, you know, listening to both of you, of course, how intuitive Jules was about how, you know, collaborative processes could work, often without, you know, necessarily the initial artist having a sense of those larger kind of ripples of possibility. But bringing elements together, of course, finally, you know, this conversation with remarkable space for both of you, but also other, you know, human collaborators along the way and teasing out, you know, the best possible outcomes. Billy, of course, you know, a key collaborator with Jules over many works, and we've spoken to him in this series. Thank you very much indeed, Karen. Now, Marissa, just going back a little bit to Grim Desires, of course, an image from the work became the cover of the trade edition of the Wapping Project on paper, the anthology of the Wapping Project in the hydraulic power station, which was published several years ago. And so, again, that was another form of kind of endorsement, I guess, to your work and to Jules' belief in, you know, in how you were thinking about, how you were thought about, you know, by the Wapping Project team. So, you know, again, a significant before and after for you, I imagine, following on from your restaurant piece. How did that experience of working in the boiler house at such scale, you know, with the endorsement, of course, of the organisation, impact on your work following?
It impacted on my work following in many, many different ways. And maybe, sorry, can I come back to your question before and just say something else to the building, because that really is what influenced me or my work ever after. It's really working in the boiler house and working site specifically that has stayed with me. And before rehearsals began for Grim Desires, I spent a lot of time in the boiler house, just sort of wandering through and exploring the space on my own. And I was struck by its vastness and its depths, and of course its height. On one hand, it was a sort of cold and seemingly forlorn, gigantic space. with its lost former industrial purpose, and on the other hand, one could see many details and architectural features if one looked closely. And to me, the details and different textures seemed like layers of history written into the walls, reminiscences of the past that very much fueled my imagination. And there were, of course, further spaces sort of adjoining the vast boiler house. For example, the coal room at the opposite side of the boiler house entrance. And similarly, the wall on the left of the boiler house had windows that suggested further hidden spaces behind the wall. And in fact, that photo you referred to was from the end of the piece and happened in those windows. And these windows started about 3 to 4 meters above ground level and indicated a second story floor. And whenever I had been in the space, these windows were blacked out or boarded up. And I asked if it was possible to open them. And both Jules and Josh really wanted to facilitate and support my ideas. And so Josh opened the windows. Josh was Jules' husband, an architect, production manager, and kind of the magician of the space. He was brilliant in finding practical solutions for artistic ideas that seemed sometimes really impossible. And once he had opened up the windows, it became clear to me that they had to become a major focus of the choreography. And so Josh, the magician he sort of built a three-story scaffold tower behind the wall so the performers could use these platforms. And this meant from inside the boiler house, they appeared to be on an imaginary second floor of the adjoining room. This focus on finding frames, for example, helped me later when working outdoors to not lose the performance in the vastness of the outdoor space, but instead to mold the performance into frames that the landscape and the architecture outside could offer. And in an evolved way, this focus on framing becomes even more important in my current work, which is film-based and a series of short films and installations for galleries. And I had learned at Wapping how to work in a challenging environment, and this experience made me kind of fearless in exploring difficult spaces and situations later on. In fact, I think it sparked my obsession with industrial and abandoned spaces. And so despite my work being very different today, there are still certain strands to it that could only have developed and evolved out of seeds that were sown when I worked at Wapping. They may have sort of cross-pollinated with many other experiences, but the traces are still there. And I'm very grateful for having been nourished by the opportunity and these experiences that Jules offered me and her support and trust.
Thank you very much indeed, Marissa. No, it's very interesting, isn't it, how obviously what a singular encounter the Wapping Project offers, of course, but then how some of the lessons that it draws out of its artists and practitioners find expression in different ways. And we will come on to that just before the close. But Karen, very interesting what Marissa said there about the traces of history, of course, in the building, the layers of experience that are almost marked on the walls and in the architecture, which, you know, made the space a perfect kind of home for your work, of course, in relation to Sebald and the Austerlitz project. Now, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, a very significant moment for you to see such an installation of your work. And now carrying forward, of course, you continued that relationship with the Wapping Project with the installation of The Lady from the Sea in your own gallery in Berlin, a work by Thomas and Jules in 2016 and Marta's exhibition Without in 2017. So there's a very practical, of course, and mutually supportive collaboration there with the Wapping Project personnel. But what was your sense following on from Austerlitz of where your work would take you? And perhaps, you know, if it was inspired by the experience of being in that very building?
Yeah, it's indeed a big influence, and it still is in my photography and in my way of thinking of exhibiting, that I don't like so much white cubes no more, but think of installations. And there's actually one work which I started in London when I've been there all the time and working with Wapping, which is called The Man Who Fell from Sky, which is about the stowaways falling from the wheel wells when they're heading to Heathrow. And I followed these traces and took pictures for many, many years. And I actually started it when Jules was still alive, and she kept on asking me, like, why do you want to do it? And it's just this question I have so often in my head, and I think that's the basic question, right? Why do you want to do it? What do you want to tell? And as I said earlier, before, I was more conceptual, working with conceptual exposure times, etc. And now it's more to storytelling that I want to tell these stories. It's just a bit more difficult to think in installations when it comes to exhibition spaces. Like, some people I told about this work, and then there was no space, wasn't big enough, and so on. But I actually asked, speaking about corporations and collaborations, I asked Billy Cowie as well for the sound, and he did make it. And actually did exhibit Billy at my space in Berlin too. And he once said, because I said, I want installation, I want storytelling. And he once said that, oh, you're mini Jules. I found that very sweet. But I wouldn't say that even. I would say mini Jules maybe. But yeah, it's the big influence. And when I exhibited the Austerlitz show in Berlin now, of course, it's such a different space, so much smaller than Wapping. And I try not to compare it, because it did work in Berlin too, but of course less impressive, because the power station you can't copy anyway.
Actually, can I add something to that?
No, please do. Please do, Marissa, yeah.
Because that really, how do you say, I really know exactly what you're saying, Karen. Because this scale that the Boiler House offered, you know, you can't find hardly anywhere else. And I think I went, after I worked at Wapping, I created stage pieces that toured. And after a couple of years, I think I had to leave the black box, because I was missing this idea of scale and playing with different scales and depths of field and height and sight. And I went outdoors, and I think it was partially because of my experience at Wapping that sort of made me restless and want to explore spaces in different ways. Sort of when I'm thinking of exhibition spaces now for what I'm creating at the moment, I love the idea again of a huge space. And I think I got spoiled working at Wapping so early on, because one just doesn't find these spaces very often. And it's funny, because in France I've been offered to potentially work at a Victorian paper mill, and they said to me, oh, you can just use this tiny space, the first room, if you want, because I know it's such a huge space. And I was like, no, I want the entire space, please, and all five sort of rooms. And I think it really comes from having worked at Wapping.
Thank you, Marissa, and thank you very much indeed, Karen. I mean, I think what's very clear, of course, from both your reminiscences is this idea of you know, the ambition that Jules kind of instilled in her creative collaborators, and the sense of possibility, always, you know, choosing to make something work rather than to default to the setting that, of course, it might not be possible. And
sorry, can I just say something else about Jules that I found really struck me about her? And
please do, Marissa, yeah.
What I came to particularly admire about Jules was her ability to take risks and to encourage and support artists in taking risks too. She enabled artists to realize their potential not by getting them to do what they were best at, but by encouraging them to explore new territory and to get out of their comfort zone. And I think for her, art was about challenge and about invention and about being brave enough to also face potential failure. And she encouraged one to take risks, but also she shared the burden of that risk. And in my case, I mean, she took a huge risk committing to presenting Grim Desires for whole months every evening in London. And she well knew this was going to be my first evening-long piece, my first major site-specific work, my first time choreographing scenes at height. There were so many firsts, the whole thing could have easily backfired and been a complete disaster. But it didn't, and instead, as Jules had intended, it sold out every night. And I think it was her encouragement and trust that gave me and my collaborators the confidence to carry it off. In a unique way, she fully stood by the artist she presented. And when we now look back and sort of marvel about what extraordinary work Jules made happen, I believe it is partially due to that trust in the artist and her sharing, her encouragement and facilitation of risk-taking.
Thank you very much indeed. And Karen, is there anything else that we haven't covered that you'd like to add?
This just put tears to my eyes because I think it's so true what Marisa just said.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you so much indeed, Karen and Maresta. It's been a real pleasure hearing your reminiscences of your time with Jules, of course, of the very significant encounter in both your lives and careers with such an extraordinary and remarkable producer, and of course with the equally distinctive Wapping Hydraulic Power Station, the restaurant and the boiler house. Thank you very, very much indeed for your time today. And in the next episode, I will be in conversation with a remarkable quartet of Omani artists as part of the direction that Marta and Thomas took for the Wapping project, moving, of course, well beyond the dampness of the Wapping project in its Wapping incarnation to the very different landscape of the Middle East. So I do hope you can join me for that. And until then, thank you very much indeed for listening today, and goodbye.